reproach, concern. Quietly, he said, maybe you're right. North Atlantic, December 1914, 6 weeks later. The Josefina Eterna burned. A floating pyre, a raft of flames. It listed to starboard, slowly, slowly, as though easing over to douse itself in the sea. Smooth black water, a dense blue dawn fog diffusing the fire's glow. Under the surface, a frill of ragged steel and busted rivets, water in the boiler rooms, extinguishing the furnaces and drowning the stokers, flooding the forward holds, rising through the plumbing and pouring from sinks and tubs and toilets, running down passageways and up elevator shafts, water that slowly, slowly pulled the ship onto her side, tugged her bow down. Her engines were dead, her propellers still. Smoke billowed from the stairwells, and passengers in white nightclothes billowed with it, already ghosts. Addison intended to drown. He would stand stoically on deck, wait for the water to rise up the buttons of his coat, submerge his gold epaulettes, sweep him away. When he'd imagined such a moment, he had always known he would take the honorable course, but he'd never contemplated having a wife on board, certainly not two infants. He had been the one to insist Annabelle come on the voyage. He'd almost needed to scrape her out of bed with the shovel Lloyd had suggested, but something had to be done. You can't be this miserable forever, he'd told her. I don't see why not, she'd replied. Fresh sea air would do her good, he'd said confidently, feeling no confidence. He'd issued his orders, the ship, the air. She had yielded. No nurses, he'd said. She must care for the children herself. She had yielded. She had come aboard like a piece of baggage, silent and passively unwieldy. On some level, the experiment had appeared successful. Before the voyage, Annabelle had not taken care of the babies for even a single day. But once forced, she had somehow known how to swaddle them and change their diapers and plug their small mouths with bottles of a warm mixture of cow's milk, sugar, and cod liver oil, made according to the night nurse's written formula, and brought at all hours from the ship's kitchen. Addison might have felt vindicated if there hadn't been something not quite right about how Annabelle went about her maternal tasks. Blank-faced, mechanical as a mill worker. One night, he had found her standing at the stern, looking down into the dark water. They were 5 days out when the explosion occurred. Still a full day from Liverpool, slowed by the fog, entering a region of the sea bristling with periscopes and studded with mines. Only 523 passengers were on board, with room for three times that. The crew outnumbered them. Addison had been awake when the blast came, before dawn. Driven mad by the wailing of one twin while Annabelle fed the other, he had snatched up bottle and baby, and brought both into bed with him. As soon as the rubber nipple was in its mouth, the child had quieted, its pale eyes intent on his face. Addison loosened the swaddling, and a pair of mottled pink hands emerged. Which one is this? He said. Where she sat, Annabelle's face was in shadow. I don't know, she said. It doesn't matter. The baby's body pulsed in his lap. Its small fingers flared and curled. He felt the change of pressure in his ears before he heard the blast. The sound came from everywhere, permeating the air. The ship shuddered and seemed to twist. A whoosh, a second of suspended silence, then water raining down, grinding vibration followed by quiet. What was that? Annabelle said, sharp, not fearful. He dressed hastily. A section of the starboard railing was mangled and twisted. Smoke and steam drove him back when he went to look over. A fire alarm rang shrilly, maddeningly. On the bridge, he ordered the engine room be telegraphed stop, though the engines had already gone dead. He sent the third officer below to investigate. Already, the list to starboard was noticeable. He stood motionless, looking at his boots, calculating. Fog pressed flat against the bridge windows like a blindfold. "Ready the boats," he said. "Sound the general alarm." In the radio room, the operators tapped out distress calls, dots and dashes. The nearest ship, a merchant vessel, was 30 nautical miles away and coming full speed. But it would not arrive for 2 hours. He considered the fire, the starboard list, the blue fog, the black water. "Abandon ship," he said to the first mate, who shouted it to the other officers, who shouted it in return. A strange echo, growing louder instead of fading. The boat deck was in chaos. Crew members with megaphones yelled instructions over the passengers' commotion, the cranking davits, the hiss of steam. Addison strode the length of the ship, trying to impose order. He told himself he would only duck away for a moment, only ensure that Annabelle was on her way to the boats with the babies and bid them a brief, stoic farewell. He made his way through the smoke and clamor. The simple fact that Annabelle was not in the cabin dawned on him with dreamlike slowness. The two swaddled infants screamed in their basket. Annabelle was not in the armchair or in the bed. She was not in the bathroom, where seawater was pouring from the fixtures. The babies' faces were purple and contorted with outrage, their spongy pink tongues curling in their shrieking mouths. He opened the wardrobe, but of course Annabelle was not inside. He stepped out into the corridor, called her name, then shouted it. Long ago, Addison had trained himself not to hesitate. If he had hesitated before throwing that line to Lloyd, his friend would have drowned, would never have been his friend. But now he hesitated, standing in the middle of the cabin, waiting for something to change, for some solution to emerge. Finally, still hesitantly, he went to the wardrobe and removed his pistol from its case, loaded it, and dropped it in the pocket of his greatcoat. He lifted the babies from their basket, one in each arm. Down the tilting stairs, out a heavy tilted steel door by pressing the latch with an elbow, pushing with a shoulder. He found the twins' flopping heads alarming, their larval bodies cumbersome. On the boat deck, pressing aft through a panicked mob, he craned and swiveled, looking for Annabelle. Where was she? The question rang in his mind, deafening and relentless. A quiet voice, speaking from some silent inner part of him, answered, "You won't find her. If she had planned to return, she would not have left." Deep scrums had formed around the boats not yet launched or on fire or beached on the sloping portside hull. A dangerous gap was opening between the starboard boats and the ship's edge. As Addison passed, a lowering boat wobbled on its ropes, tipped and overturned, dumping people into a sea already teeming with them. Addison felt little for them. People were dying, but soon he would die too. At boat 12, he stopped. The gap was widening. This boat would be among the last launched. With one arm, he clamped the babies against his body. With the other, he drew his pistol and shot into the air. The passengers screamed and fell away, half flattened like tall grass in a gust of wind. He pushed through to the edge of the deck, brandishing the gun, Back, he told them. Get back. He cleared a half moon of space so those going in the boat would have room for a few steps running start before leaping over the gap, the strip of far below black water. The crewmen at the davits, probably doomed themselves, tried to hold the boat steady with hooked poles. The babies cried, but Addison barely heard them. One by one, he selected those who would go in the boat, pulling them out of the crowd, signaling with a flick of the pistol when it was their turn to leap over the gap. Women and children. The women gathered their skirts and jumped. None fell. He began to look for which woman he would hand his children to, who could be trusted to survive. When the boat was full, he still couldn't see a face he liked. They were all just strangers, just women with fearful eyes and mouths that jabbered or trembled. In his arms were babies about to be orphaned. He stepped close to the edge, grasping the swaddling of one infant, preparing to hand it across. He didn't know which twin it was. He was eager to shed his burden, to feel the rising water. His mistake was to look at the baby's face, a nod of helpless outrage. One glance dizzied him like an uppercut to the jaw. The water receded, spat him out. How could he entrust his children to unknown women in a small tippy boat? How could he send them off across a sea full of drowning people who would reach up to grasp at the oars and gunwales like monsters from the deep? He saw the lifeboat capsizing, the baby's white swaddling fading into the depths like the canvas shrouds he had, in his sailing days, helped wrap around the dead before sliding them overboard. No. He needed to know if they lived, to see them to land or to death himself. He gathered both twins to his chest, took two long steps, and leapt across into the boat. The close-packed women drew back, and he half fell, half stepped among them, his body curving to protect the babies. Regaining his balance, he drew himself up to his full height and roared into the crewmen's astonished faces, "Lower away!" Trained to obey, remembering the pistol, they worked the squeaking pulleys. Boat 12, with its cargo of women and children and one man, dropped away from the crowd and the smoke, descended past flames poking around the edges of portholes like the fingers of trapped demons. Slowly, jerkily, it made its way down to the water, where it settled with a gentle splash. New York City, July 1915, 7 months later. A new Pfeiffer son, born in the night after a short labor. The baby was severed from his mother, nodded off into his own selfhood, bathed and wrapped and fed from the breast. George. Named after the king, a fifth son, though the five Pfeiffer boys would never be all together on this earth. Lloyd collapsed beside Matilda, dressed but collar undone, tiny George between them.
"How do you feel?" he said.
"Tired," she said with a note of incredulity that she must say so, "but happy, and relieved to be happy. That surge of feeling, I had it with the others, but I didn't know if it was still possible." He rested a finger against the infant's cheek. Since Matilda had discovered she was pregnant, not long before the loss of the Josephina, Lloyd had been, as a gesture of atonement and superstition, faithful. He'd found, these 8 months, a monkish peacefulness in a life with only one woman. Though there was nothing monkish about how his new fortune was accruing thanks to the war, raining merrily down on top of his old one. He had been sloppy with the Josephina, eager and amateurish, driven by anger at his father and grief for Leander, and he had paid a terrible price. Of course, the hundreds burned and drowned had paid a worse one,
and Addison Graves had been sent to Sing Sing, Lloyd had only wanted to contribute to the effort against the Germans, to do something. And when his friend, Sir Gerald de Redvers, had suggested he might smuggle armaments to England on his ships, he'd leapt at the idea. In his haste, he hadn't sought enough advice, hadn't taken enough precautions. He hadn't even told Addison what was in the crates, only asked him, told him, really, to overlook their absence on the manifest. But, he now understood, you couldn't put armaments on a ship as casually as if they were bolts of cotton, though he still didn't know what had triggered the explosion. The crates should have been safe enough. He had been assured they were properly packed. He'd assumed they were properly stowed. Something else must have gone wrong, but there was no way to know what. Some freak thing. Something that could not quite have been his own fault, not directly. "It happened because I didn't break the bottle," Matilda had said in the days after. "I cursed the ship." "It had nothing to do with you. You shouldn't have named it after that girl." "You're right," he'd said. "I am sorry." He could not remember ever apologizing to her before. Her pregnancy had been a buoy to which they'd clung during the first shock of the Josephina. The horror brought by the ringing of the telephone before dawn, the telegrammed counts of the rescued and the lost, the lists of names, the painful revisions to the counts and the lists, the photographs from the crowded decks of the freighters that had picked up survivors, including one of Addison Graves, alive, with his two babies. Lloyd had known at once that Addison would absorb the worst of the public's rage. Captain Cowardice, the press had dubbed him. And also that he would never tell anyone about the mysterious crates left off the manifest at Lloyd's request. Again, Addison would save him. He was sorry, so sorry for his friend, but what could he do? Surely Addison would not want L&O to fail, would understand that Lloyd himself must not go to prison. Matilda didn't know, of course, about the crates bound for Gerald de Redvers. She had forgiven Lloyd so much already. He could not expect her to forgive this. When the Lusitania sank 5 months after the Josephina, it had been a terrible tragedy, yes, but also, Lloyd could not deny, a help to his own situation. Who was to say the Germans hadn't also torpedoed the Josephina? Perhaps even by mistake in the fog, and not acknowledged it. Lloyd had suggested this theory to a few reporters, adding tempting incentives for those willing to write it up. The Lusitania had also been rumored to be carrying munitions of some kind. People loved a conspiracy, and they weren't wrong that the holds of ships were good places to store secrets. Since the wreck, Lloyd had avoided transporting weapons. There was no need, anyhow. The L&O fleet was being put to work carrying steel, lumber, rubber, wheat, beef, medical supplies, wool, horses, whatever was needed. He'd acquired a few tanker ships, which in turn had led him to develop enough of an interest in the petroleum industry that he'd quietly started up a little subsidiary in Texas. Just a modest experimental outpost with a couple of geologists, a few wildcatters, an agent who negotiated leases on patches of wasteland. Liberty Oil, Lloyd was calling the venture. The Maria Fortuna had gone to work as a troop ship for the Canadian Expeditionary Force after he'd offered the British government an exceptionally generous rate. Not pure altruism, as he retained control of the cargo holds. Her tidy paint job disappeared under a chaos of razzle-dazzle, wild stripes and checkers and false bow waves designed to confuse rangefinders. Quite possibly at some point the United States would enter the war, and when it did, more ships would be needed. Lloyd would be ready. Some of his vessels would be lost, but he had become less afraid of loss, inoculated against it. The dark spirit had left him, or perhaps he'd absorbed it into himself without noticing. Sadness still weighed on him, but his heart beat on, his lungs swelled and contracted, his collar was impeccably white. He walked at a clip. He had no time for mistresses, for soft afternoons playing at love. He required all his dignity. Despite his best intentions, this bout of fidelity would last the duration of the war, but no longer. What appetite he had for variety, he channeled into business. He would be a titan. He was in the midst of a beginning. The sleeping baby, feeling his first night breeze, was the son of a new Lloyd Pfeiffer. Near Missoula, Montana, May 1923, 8 years and 5 months after the sinking of the Josephina. Marion and Jamie Graves walked along a track above a creek. Marion in front, Jamie behind. Tall for their age, nearly identical except for the girl's braid. Blonde, skinny children flickering through the trees, through slants of sunlight thick with dust and pollen. Both wore flannel shirts and bib overalls tucked into rubber boots bought for them by Barrett, their uncle's Norwegian housekeeper. The boots made a particular flapping sound against their shins. Downstream, their Uncle Wallace sat with his watercolors and a pad of stiff, thick paper onto which he was transferring the creek, the trees, the mountains. Where the sun glinted off water and rocks, he left tiny voids of white. He was conscious of nothing but the movement of his eyes and brush. When he painted, he had no memory of ever having received two small wards, of having released them into the wilderness like a pair of dogs trusted to return eventually. If he worried about the children, he could not paint, and so he didn't worry. Still farther downstream, in the ancient glacial lake bed where Missoula sat, near the lower reaches of this creek, the Rattlesnake, was a gabled Queen Anne house with a screened porch and a round turret. Its inhabitants were Wallace and the twins, and most days Barrett, doing her best to stave off squalor. Though the exterior was shabbily kept, with flaking paint and missing shingles, and the furniture was old and threadbare, she made sure everything was at least well dusted, well scoured, well polished. Out back, a gray gelding called Fiddler had a one-stall barn and small paddock. And there was a cottage Wallace offered to his friends when they fought with their wives or ran short of money. Past the house, the Rattlesnake flowed under the railway bridge to join the Clark Fork River as it swept through town and away to the northwest. By the time the Clark Fork ended in Lake Ponderay, the Blackfoot and Bitterroot and Thompson Rivers had all joined too, and from the lake, they became the Columbia River, and from the Columbia, the Pacific. Water was always on its way somewhere bigger, according to Wallace. "Nothing's bigger than the ocean, though," Marion told him. "The sky is," said Wallace. The twins knew if they kept going upstream, they would find an old shack, then a stretch of white water, and then, best of all, a wrecked and rusted open-top Model T, which, depending on how high the creek was running, was sometimes on the shore and sometimes half-submerged. How the car had come to be in the creek was a mystery. The track the children followed was narrow and rutted, suitable only for travel by foot or horseback. Wallace didn't know. Barrett didn't know. Wallace's bohemian friends from the university made fanciful guesses, but in the end, didn't know. After Marion and Jamie passed the shack, they began to hurry, though both tried not to let on. Their hands stayed in their pockets. Their postures suggested a leisurely stroll, but their legs moved faster. Each wanted to sit behind the Ford's cracked wheel and pretend to drive. Whoever was not driving played at mechanic or bandit or servant. All fine roles, but not as good as driver. Sometimes, for variety, the car was a ship, and they took turns pretending to be their father at the helm. Sometimes the ship sank, and they went with it. They knew what people said about their father, and they were angry at him for making them contend with life as children of a famous coward. Their mother never figured into their games. They rounded the last bend and took off running, swiping with skinny arms, shoving each other toward ruts and rocks. Gup, gup, gup. But when they burst out of the trees, instead of throwing themselves into the final sprint, both stopped. The creek was high with snowmelt, and the car had been pulled deeper into the water, submerging the wheels and what was left of the floorboards. The remains of its front wheels had caught in the rocks, though not very securely. The body was swaying with the creek's flow. "It'll be more like really driving the way it's moving," Marion said.
"Don't you think it might get loose?" said Jamie.
"Scared?"
"No, but I don't want to drown, neither."
"You couldn't drown. It's just a creek."
Jamie studied the water doubtfully. The creek's slick brown middle was lumpy and choppy and white-capped from submerged rocks and cold whip ends of currents snapping up underneath.
"We could go play in the shack instead," he said.
"You're scared," said Marion.
For an answer, he splashed in. Water poured into his boots, but he pressed ahead, straining like a man dragging a boulder behind him. Ordinarily, they swam naked, but the car was unfriendly to skin, all jagged metal and flaking rust, stiff shreds of leather and wisps of dank wool clinging to rusty springs. So, swamped boots, wet overalls. He lifted one heavy leg to the running board and clambered into the driver's seat. The brake lever stuck up from the water like a reed. Marion did not like the way the car shifted under Jamie's slight weight, how Whitewater was shouldering at the bumper the way Wallace did when his Cadillac got stuck in mud.
"You don't have to come in," Jamie called. "I won't say you're yellow."
But Marion stepped into the creek. The current was fast, the creek bed uneven, and she held out her arms for balance. Icy water splashed into her boots.
"Move over,"
she told Jamie when she reached the car.
"You always drive. Go around.
It's too deep over there.
Climb over then."
As Marion grabbed at the edge of the ruined back seat, the car tipped, and its right front wheel came loose from the rocks. She let go, dropping back down into the creek. The car's body slewed around so the current hit it broadside, rushing up over the floor. Jamie gaped at her as his chariot swayed and then slid toward the deeper water, the freer current. Floating now, the Ford pivoted languidly and plowed forward, the radiator disappearing little by little under the water. It didn't go far. Once the wheels caught in the rocks again, water poured in over Jamie. Marion, trotting along the bank, called to him. His pale head disappeared and resurfaced in the current, sleek and small, swept along. Stumbling on the rocky shore, Marion couldn't keep up and for a moment lost sight of him entirely. Panting, ducking under branches, she rounded a bend. There he was, sitting on a sandbar. Drenched and breathing heavily, his overalls dark and heavy, his boots gone, Jamie got to his feet. Then he let out the kind of wild, exultant whoop she'd only heard grown men make. He stomped his feet, picked up a rock and hurled it into the creek, raised his knobby arms. She was filled with a terrible envy.
She wanted to be the one who had survived.
Ossining, New York, August 1924. 1 year and 3 months later. When Addison emerged from the gates of Sing Sing, his lawyer, Chester Fine, was there waiting, his three-piece suit characteristically rumpled, engrossed in a book he held in one hand. Chester had taken the train up from the city, and he rode back down again with Addison, the two of them watching the passing Hudson in silence. For years, Chester had been Addison's only visitor. Lloyd Pfeiffer had shown up one Sunday early on, but Addison had declined to see him. Later, the clerk in the canteen said Lloyd had added $40 to his account. But Addison was careful not to spend it. Lloyd had also sent a few letters that Addison threw away unopened. And he'd offered to buy Addison's house for an inflated price that Chester relayed one Sunday. "Mr. Pfeiffer asked me to tell you it's the least he can do," Chester had said in the crowded visiting room. Both men were perched on wooden stools and separated by a waist-high divider, Chester in his wrinkled suit, Addison in his gray uniform. "He says he wants to do something for the twins." "The twins don't need his money. They might someday. And Pfeiffer's never criticized you or scapegoated you. At least not publicly. That's a loud silence." "I hauled him out of the sea once when we were young. He took it to heart."
Addison rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands.
"No. Sell the house to someone who's not Pfeiffer. Sell everything in the house that can be sold and throw the rest away."
"Everything? There's nothing of sentimental value? Nothing of their mother's to be kept for the twins?"
"Nothing."
When Addison was released, 6 months early, thanks to Chester Fine's persistent efforts, the $43.66 left in his canteen account was handed to him in an envelope that he slid into his inside pocket. Otherwise, he carried only a slender cardboard portfolio tied closed with string. In Grand Central, Chester Fine shook his hand, bid him good luck and goodbye, handed him a train ticket, and was gone with a doff of his hat. Addison looked around. Pale light descended from the high windows at a stately angle. Higher still, noble gold zodiac figures and a smattering of stars occupied a tranquil blue-green heaven. It had been more than 9 years since he'd stood under the real stars. All around, people scattered across the grand marble floor and rattled away down tunnels like dropped ball bearings. They were disorienting, even frightening in their numbers, their hurry, their prosperity, their freedom. He had grown accustomed to being watched at all times, and he had, without realizing, assumed that when he returned to the world, he would still be famous as the cowardly captain of the Josephina Eterna. He had foreseen jeering crowds at the gates of Sing Sing, recognition and revilement everywhere he went. Instead, he found bustling, indifferent strangers. Under painted stars, with a dismal burst of pleasure, he understood he had been forgotten. He bought a ham sandwich, dropped Lloyd Pfeiffer's $40 in a beggar's cap, descended a tunnel and boarded the 20th Century Limited to Chicago. After waiting around for most of a day, not venturing out of the station, he caught a train to Missoula. A clear, warm night with a bright, nearly full moon. Wallace Graves waited at the depot. He had brought one of the household dogs, a leggy black and white thing, and they looked down the tracks together as the train's headlight grew larger and its huffing louder. The locomotive passed in a burst of heat and screeching brakes. Framed by sliding, slowing yellow rectangles of light, people were standing, putting on hats, gathering possessions. Doors opened and figures descended. Porters heaved trunks from the baggage car. Wallace picked out Addison's stooped and looming silhouette on the platform. He held up a hand, and Addison nodded as though greeting an acquaintance and not a brother, not ending a separation of nearly two decades. When Wallace embraced him, he felt as though he were clutching an oversized skeleton to his bosom. "Where's your luggage?" he said. Addison bent to greet the dog. "I don't have any." "You have that." Wallace indicated the slim cardboard parcel under Addison's arm. "What's in it?"
Addison cleared his throat.
"Your letters and the photographs you sent, and your drawings of the children." Addison had never acknowledged any of the dozens of portraits Wallace had sent. And for years, Wallace had imagined them vanishing into the prison garbage. They were only little jots, sketches in ink and watercolor, easily done. But still, the thought of any of his work being destroyed gave him a helpless, horrified feeling. Now the slender cardboard portfolio, carefully tied, brought a tightness to his throat. When Addison left home for the sea, Wallace had been a small boy, separated from his brother by 10 years and a little crop of nameless gravestones out under a walnut tree. Stillbirths. When, 11 years later, he'd made his own escape from their silent parents and the hardscrabble family farm, he'd set his course for the address scrawled in the upper left corner of Addison's brief annual letters. A red brick house near the Hudson. Even as a young man, Addison had been taciturn and inscrutable. But he let Wallace live with him, among his paltry furnishings and bewildering souvenirs from far-flung places. He had even paid for Wallace to go to art school. Wallace gestured toward the depot. "Come, this way." His long gray Cadillac touring car, his special joy, was parked out front. It had originally come to him in a card game during his great winning streak of 1913, a month when he'd gambled his way through a succession of mining towns and won not only the car but enough gold dust to visit every brothel he happened past and then to buy himself a house, too. A wise decision, it turned out, to sink his assets into the house before the great losing streak of 1915. He had taken care to park the car under a street lamp, so Addison would be better able to admire it. The black trim still gleaming, the top folded back, the thick, deep-treaded tires helpful for getting out en plein air, the front and rear seats in black leather, extravagantly scratched by dog nails.
"Marion is enamored with it," he told Addison. "She's a funny one. I'm always finding her outside polishing it or poking around the engine. When I take it to a mechanic, I drop her off too so she can watch."
"You said so in a letter."
"It's just that you never reply."
Wallace opened the passenger door with a flourish, gesturing his brother inside. The dog snaked in first and bounced into the back seat.
"You must be desperate to see the twins. They wanted to come along, but I told them we shouldn't mob you. It's late anyway. They'll be asleep, but you can peek in at them. They sleep out on the porch when it's not cold. Well, when it's not dangerously cold."
"I know," Addison said, pulling the door shut. "I read the letters."
"But you don't reply."
Wallace went around, settled in the driver's seat.
"Thank you, though, for the financial support. It's been very welcome."
He started the engine.
"Home's not far."
Pulling away from the curb, he went on,
"I've put the fear of God into Jamie and Marion not to wake you in the morning. They get up horribly early. They're practiced at entertaining themselves until a decent hour. They go up the creek, up the mountains. I don't know where they go. I hope that doesn't sound neglectful. I couldn't stop them if I tried. They take the horse, usually.
Do you know how to drive?
No. Not much call to at sea. Nor in prison.
I suppose not, no.
You'll pick it up right away. I'll teach you.
Marion can already do everything except reach the pedals and see over the steering wheel at the same time.
It's still one or the other. Jamie is less interested in learning, less insistent about learning, I should say. Generally, he gives Marion's passions a wide berth. He's not one to jostle. He's quite tender. You'll see.
Driving, though, once you've got the hang of it, you'll be able to get around on your own. We might even think about finding you a car. I think you'd like...
Wallace, Addison interrupted. Is there somewhere we could go to swim?
Swim?
Yes.
Let me think.
Wallace slowed the car, wanting to please. Not the Clark Fork or the Bitter Root, not at night. An idea came.
There might be somewhere.
He turned west, presently steered onto a gravel track that became a dirt lane. Trees grew alongside, though not densely, and the air was cool. A leaping deer caught in the headlights seemed to float over the rutted track and was gone. Addison winced as they jounced and rattled, and Wallace had to fight the urge to apologize, as though this expedition had been his idea, as though any of it were his idea. He had never wanted children, never wanted to be anything other than a bachelor, and yet he had not hesitated to respond in the affirmative to Chester Fine's telegrammed question, to take in two babies who would grow into two children who would occupy his house, his time, some portion of his attention. He had swept his seedier appetites to the edges of his life, mostly out of sight. Willingly, he had done all this. He had studied Jamie and Marion for clues about the character of his own brother, whom he had never known well. He wondered if Marion's obstinacy was from her father or from the mythical Annabelle. Wondered who had bequeathed Jamie his almost debilitating horror of animal suffering. The boy was undone by birds fallen from the nest, injured rabbits, stray dogs, whipped horses. Cruelty was inextricable from life, Wallace tried to explain. But Jamie was not easily persuaded or consoled. No mystery why there were seldom fewer than 5 dogs in the house. Though Wallace was eager to have Addison take a share of responsibility for the children, he'd also been surprised by his pleasure that Addison had, tersely, accepted his offer to stay in the cottage after his release, and by his relief that Addison did not plan to take Jamie and Marion away immediately. He hadn't realized he was afraid of losing them. The lane ended at a shallow, grassy rise, the headlights angling up off the top into nothing.
There's a little pond down there, Wallace said, turning off the engine.
An insect cacophony welled up. Addison got out and folded his jacket on the seat, set his hat on top, walked toward the water. Wallace followed. It was only a little oxbow pond, a silty crescent left behind when the river had changed course. The moon floated in its fat middle. Addison began to jerk at his tie, tugging at the knot and yanking it off over his head as though escaping a hangman's noose. He shed his shirt with the same feverishness. In the moonlight, Wallace could see the knobs of his spine, the shadows under his shoulder blades. Addison pried off his shoes, peeled off his socks, fumbled with his belt and the buttons at his waist until his trousers and drawers dropped around his ankles, revealing pale buttocks. He waded in on knobby heron's legs. As the water rose around his calves, something seemed to break in him, and he charged like a maddened beast, splashing and galloping, diving under. The dog chased after him, barking. Wallace shed his clothes and followed more deliberately, the pond bottom sucking at his feet. He took a breath and sank under the surface. Surfacing, he found he could stand on his toes, but only just. Addison was floating with his arms out, his chest breaking the surface, looking at the sky. The dog's V-shaped wake disturbed the moon.
"Is this all right? Is it what you wanted?" Wallace asked.
"I haven't wanted anything for years," Addison said. "But then I wanted to swim."
Over the more than 9 years he had spent in Sing Sing, Addison had slept very little. His cell, 7 feet by 3 feet, made from limestone quarried by prisoners long since dead, was a tomb in which, after lights out, he lay perfectly still, perfectly awake, listening to the snores and murmurs and masturbatory rhythms of 800 men stacked 6 high in cells identical to his. On ships, he had always been able to sleep, no matter how rough the seas or uncomfortable his berth. In prison, the persistence of his consciousness had seemed a particularly severe aspect of his punishment, meted out not by the court, but by his soul. Addison did not sleep in the cottage either, did not wrinkle the white sheets or the blue and white quilt on the narrow bed made up by the famous Barrett. He'd found a number of crates and boxes stacked inside. Wallace said they were for him, had arrived by freight a year or two after he had entered Sing Sing. Chester Fine's name was on the shipping labels. After closing the curtains, Addison pried open a crate at random. It was full of books. His books from the house in New York. Others held the things he had collected on his journeys. Masks and carvings, animal horns, weavings, a tortoise shell, a serving tray from Brazil with butterfly wings arranged in iridescent wheels under glass. Elsewhere, carefully wrapped and padded, Addison found the paintings Wallace had made in New York and given him in lieu of rent. Docked ships, crowded streets, the Hudson, the red brick townhouse. The prosecutors had conceded that Captain Graves had not, strictly speaking, broken any law by surviving. But they pointed out that the International Convention for the Safety of Life at Sea required the captain to stay aboard until all passengers had been safely seen to. Otherwise, he was guilty of gross negligence. Furthermore, Graves had brandished a deadly weapon to prevent passengers, women even, from boarding the lifeboat, which could be construed as second-degree murder. 508 people had died. Passengers and crew, burned or drowned or floating dead from cold in their life jackets. The leading theory was that a fire smoldering in a coal bunker had ignited the coal dust that floated and drifted everywhere below decks, triggering a violent blast in one of the boilers, which had blown out the starboard hull. At most, Chester Fine countered, Captain Graves took the place of one person in the boat. And he was, after all, carrying his own infant twins, a son and daughter. Who among us could judge a man for saving his own children? Who, then, said the prosecutors, ultimately was responsible for the explosion? And who was responsible for the competence of the crew? Who was responsible for the safety and soundness of the ship? Who? I alone was responsible, Addison told Chester Fine. He asked him to plead guilty to everything, not to bargain against his atonement. But Chester, in his quiet, resolute way, ignored him. He said they must disregard public passions, which would fade. He said Addison would one day regret making a martyr of himself. And why save the twins only to abandon them again? A plea of manslaughter, everyone eventually agreed. 10 years up the Hudson.
So Addison had disappeared into Sing Sing with something like relief. Wallace had sent a studio photograph taken on the twins' first birthday. Two babies in white dresses sitting gravely in a wingback chair, their wispy, pale hair carefully combed. Sketched portraits came, too, washed with watercolor. Addison had never arrived at a settled conclusion about which twin was which and felt too foolish to ask. Every year on their birthday, another photo was sent. And slowly, the babies morphed into long-limbed, extremely blonde children. Marion, with her skeptical gaze and small, reluctant smile, bore a resemblance to Annabelle that, coupled with Wallace's stories of her willfulness, disturbed Addison. Jamie radiated earnest sweetness. Some buried occult part of him believed if he had not brought Annabelle and the twins on board the Josephina, the explosion would not have occurred. Though really, he had little doubt Lloyd's crates were to blame, or that he himself was to blame for not demanding to know what they contained, for allowing Lloyd to wave a hand and say they would be too complicated to declare. As the night faded to pewter, he inched open the curtain. The stars bowed out one by one in a way that seemed gracious, even courtly. And a memory swallowed him. Dawn on the Josephina, as a few stragglers in evening wear lingered on deck or receded down corridors, tipping, stumbling, sparkling. He felt the deck vibrating under his feet. He smelled the sea. No, it was pond water he smelled. In his hair, on his skin, clay, not brine. When the light turned lavender, two small figures emerged from the screened-in sleeping porch, three dogs tumbling out after. The children wore identical blue pajamas, and except for Marion's long hair, were nearly indistinguishable in their blondness and skinniness. They watched the cottage like cautious deer. Addison held very still. After a moment, Jamie turned sideways, fiddled with his pajamas, sent out an arc of urine. Marion turned the other way, dropped her pants, squatted in the grass. The dogs sniffed around and joined in, lifting legs. When they were done, they all went off toward where the horse was kept. The engine in Addison's chest drove pistons through his limbs. At Wallace's urging, he had peered through the sleeping porch's screen in the night and seen the twins' pale heads on pillows. He'd nodded with a furrowed brow, the way people did when shown a prized object that was meant to be admired but only baffled. He crept to a different window. Marion was sitting bareback on the gray horse in her pajamas, holding the reins as Jamie climbed the paddock fence and slid on behind her, bare feet dangling. They turned toward the creek and were gone, the horse's haunches disappearing among the trees, the dogs trotting after. Addison had never quite known whether he should believe the twins were his, but had not been willing to insult Annabelle in such a way. Now, he believed. He could see it in their arms and legs, the shape of their feet, and in some less tangible way, too, the way the morning air arranged itself around them. He believed also, resolutely, that he had nothing to offer them. He would never know what to say to them or how to be fatherly and warm. He could only disappoint and wound. All was quiet outside. He washed at the basin before he slipped out and strode quickly down the road, back the way Wallace had driven him. Less than $3 were left in his pocket, but he had more in the bank in New York. Not a fortune, but enough for now. Not long after the sun came up, he boarded a westbound train.
Los Angeles, 2014. 1. If it weren't for the thing with Jones Cohen, I wouldn't have ended up playing Marion Graves. It's not like I could have predicted that at the time, though. All I knew was I had that tight feeling in my chest, like I wanted to kick over someone's sandcastle. As a kid, I'd had that feeling a lot. I'd be on set and want to go berserk and stomp the plastic stable with the plastic pony into plastic bits. But I never acted on it until I got older. Not until I was Katie McGee and weaving down the 405 in the backseat of someone's Range Rover at 110 miles per hour. Not doing anything more than laughing and shrieking, but still feeling like I was pulverizing something. Anyway, I don't know why I went home with Jones. At the time, I would have said it was because I wanted to, but I didn't. Not really. I was bored and restless and pissed off. But none of that was new. None of that made me take Jones's hand and walk out into the light. I was tired of the light. But of course, all I did was bring more on myself. I don't remember everything. I remember sitting with Jones at the club, on a weird love seat cordoned off in its own little VIP alcove, a funereal, Victorian-looking thing with a tall, black back that curved over us like a beetle's wing. I remember the tattoo of Johnny Cash on his forearm, and his leather cuffs and turquoise rings. Sources said we were cozy and flirty, that I was being seductive, that I was all over the notorious ladies' man. But I don't remember if I suggested we leave or he did. I don't remember exactly what I said to him, but I know I would have teased him, pressing for details about the famous women he'd slept with. I would have been earnest, then tough, then soft and vulnerable. I have a vague recollection of him telling me that his next album would be stripped down as fuck, just him and his guitar. And I'd told him that sounded amazing and absolutely what you should be doing, which I sort of stand by because even though Jones's persona is douchey, he is a legitimately great guitarist. The floor was slick, and I remember slipping on our way out, one precarious shoe glissing sideways under me as we passed the shadowy coat check guy tending his hoard of unnecessary LA coats in his red-lit cave. That might have been when I took Jones's hand. The hostess told us to enjoy our evening. Pretty girl, hungry, giving me the usurper's eye. And the door opened, and the night exploded. Even drunk, with everything looming and pivoting around me, I knew they would be waiting. My rookery in their black leather and their stupid Kangol hats, shit-talking and smoking while they waited. Vigilant, their motorcycles and Vespas stacked around the block. The door opened, and their cameras went up like long black snouts. Shutters chattered. The flashes crowded in. They pressed closer until I almost choked on the light. Jones's guys elbowed them back, making a tunnel for us to the car. Hadley! Jones! Hadley! Are you together? Hadley, where's Oliver? Did you split up? In the pictures, my dress is too short. I am bleary, half-smiling, sly, clinging to Jones's hand. At least I kept my legs together getting in the car. They followed us to Jones's house in a celebratory swarm, flying along, popping white light against my window, even though it was tinted the glossy, opaque black of Japanese enamel. In the car, I remember Jones working my earring free with his tongue, pushing the hook through my lobe until the flimsy tangle of diamonds was hanging from his smile. A party trick, like tying a cherry stem into a knot. I remember his cavernous house with the usual huge abstract canvases, and everything else white as heaven in a joke about heaven. I remember a tattoo high on his inner thigh that said, in tiny, earnest capitals, "Love me." Oliver was married when I met him, when we were testing for the first Archangel movie. He was 20, and his wife was 42, a theater director from London who strode around in studded boots and asymmetrical jackets by avant-garde Japanese designers, as noble as a Roman senator. He didn't leave her for me. He didn't leave her at all. According to Oliver, after their second anniversary, she announced that her passion for him had burst like an overfull balloon, destroying itself. I didn't know about light, not really, until Oliver and I first held hands in public. It was at the premiere for the second film. We'd been secretly sleeping together for 3 months, but we were sick of all the spycraft and rumor quashing. He got out of the car first, and the thousands of crazy bitches behind the barriers screamed like they were being burned alive. When he reached back and pulled me out and didn't let go of my hand, the noise and the light seared me. I thought I would be vaporized. Nothing left except my shadow burned onto the red carpet. In the pictures, I'm glaring like a war criminal facing a tribunal. Oliver smiles, waves. Light is the medium of his beauty. In person, he is excessively handsome, obviously, but on film, he transfixes. Between the projector and the screen, he is changed into something almost unbearable to look at. The sound and the light on the red carpet wasn't for us, though. Not really. By getting together, we were making the story seem real. And the crazy bitches wanted the story to be real so badly they lost themselves. An especially radicalized splinter sect were the ones who wrote the hardcore erotic fan fiction. They tunneled through the internet, digging a labyrinth where they could pile up their desires and nurse them like larvae. They were ruining it for themselves, and they didn't even know. They didn't realize they wouldn't like the books if the story gave them exactly what they wanted. People like stories that leave them a little frustrated, that have an itch. The bitches wanted Archangel to be tailored to all their most secret kinks. But they wanted it to be inviolate, too. Whenever we changed any tiny thing in the movies, they got in touch. Lisbeth's house is sky blue, not blue-green, you morons. Or, Gabriel is wearing an Arc de Bear hat when he and Katarina kiss for the first time, which should be white, not gray, which you should know because it says in the book. Not that Oliver and I didn't get greedy, too. The characters lingered in us. We thought we could ride all the longing and passion we'd been acting like an updraft. We felt magnanimous when we got together, like we were fulfilling an obligation to the story. But the crazy bitches wrote about us, too. Us, the people, Hadley Baxter and Oliver Trapman. The actors in L.A., not Katarina and Gabriel, the figments of Gwendolyn's imagination who live in the non-existent empire of Archangel. Oliver and I once read some fan fiction about ourselves, just to see. At first, we laughed at the typos. And then we got quiet, me sitting on his lap while we read a clammy-palmed fantasy about us fucking for the first time. "I only want you," Oliver said to me in that story, like Gabriel says to Katarina 1,000 times. "Forever." But then, in a move that would have scandalized dear polite Gabriel, fanfiction Oliver pulled up my expensive couture designer gown and got me with his throbbing cock. "Give it to me," moaned Hadley. Oh, yeah. You are such a hot and famous movie star, and I live you so, so much. Oliver closed the computer. Out the window, a hummingbird appeared, attracted by the morning glory that grew on that wall of my house. It hovered and looked in at us quizzically, its iridescent chest hanging still in space, its wings nearly invisible with speed. We were sitting at a busy intersection of realities. We could feel the celestial wind. I live you so much, we started saying to each other. We is safer than I when you're inside it, but it's a tippy thing, unreliable, ready at any moment to toss you away and leave you exposed as an I after all. Once you are a we, you are also a them, a target to be spotted and photographed, a prize, a quarry, by which I mean something to be stalked, and also a pit mine. We were spotted and photographed together in New York, Paris, St. Petersburg, Cabo, Kauai, on a yacht off Ibiza, partying après ski in Gstaad, at the grocery store, at the gas station, hungover at Umami Burger. They mined us for stories, tidbits, truths and lies, lies and truths, fashion tips, fitness tips, diet tips, hair tips, relationship tips, come on, baby, just the tips. They raided our outfits, scored our beach bodies, announced I was pregnant with twins. I wanted to be pregnant with twins. Announced I was going to rehab. Announced we were engaged. Announced our engagement was off. They wanted to know what was in my purse, in my closet, on my list of beauty must-haves. They scraped away at us, made us into something ransacked and empty. When I walked out of that club with Jones, I think it was the crazy bitches I wanted to wound. In my drunken grandiosity, I imagined I had the power to bring their worlds crashing down. But like any idiot could have predicted, the bitches weathered the trauma just fine. It was my own sandcastle I was kicking over, of course, stomping it into nice, hard, flat, empty beach. The tagline for the first film was, "Love once, love forever." For the fourth film, my last, it was, "Fall once, fall forever." On the poster, a photoshopped brooding Oliver and a photoshopped pouty me were superimposed on a beautiful but ominous digital city, its skyline of gold onion domes dusted with snow. What will be the tagline for the sixth film? The tenth? Die already, for the love of God, die forever? Gwendolyn keeps writing. There are 7 books now. But even before I got fired, Oliver and I were aging faster than our characters. We couldn't be them forever. Or I couldn't keep being Katerina. Everyone knows men don't get old, at least not in a way that matters. They're filming the 5th one now. The girl who replaced me is a teenager. The creepy thing is, Oliver and I had first fucked in a car. But it was after the Kids' Choice Awards, not a premiere. The first Archangel movie won everything the kids could choose to award it. Has there ever been a bigger lie than, "I only want you," or "forever"? Who was the first person to say that nothing lasts forever? Who was the first to notice that nothing does? 2. The morning after I went home with Jones, Oliver's stuff was gone from my house. My bodyguard and assistant said that his bodyguard and assistant had come over in the middle of the night to collect everything after the first pictures showed up online. I'd been home for 5 minutes when my agent, Siobhan, called to check in and politely inquire what I could possibly have been thinking. In the afternoon, she called back to relay a partial list of people who were upset with me. She herself was on it. That was implied, although she didn't yell at me the way she would have back in the early days, when we were both psyched out of our minds if I landed a commercial for microwavable pizza dumplings. Last year, I made $32 million, and she gets 10%. When you're as famous as I am, you're like an immense gliding sea creature, an ecosystem of your own, feeding a colony of small fry on whatever's left over in your teeth. Alexi Young, Oliver's agent, whom I'd had sex with twice, secretly, and might still be in love with, told Siobhan that Oliver was heartbroken and devastated, which Siobhan relayed to me. The general entity of the studio was upset, and specifically the head of the studio, Gavin Dupre, to whom I've given one blowjob and not because I wanted to. The investors were upset, as was Gwendolyn, the author of the Archangel books, and also the director who'd done the fourth movie, which was in post-production, and the guy who was slated to direct the fifth. The studio, Siobhan said, is concerned that people, the fans, are taking this news very personally. The studio is worried you've punctured the romantic illusion. Obviously, this whole franchise hinges on this idea of perfect love, and the thinking is... I interrupted. It's really not my fault if people are too stupid to tell the difference between reality and a story. Yes, I agree, in theory, but I do think an argument could be made that we all have a responsibility to protect the brand. I can't really claim to anyone that you haven't pulled focus from the movie. I didn't say anything. She said, "Have you talked to Oliver yet?" "No, but by the way, he cheated too. I told you about that." "But it never really leaked. If a tree cheats in the woods and nobody takes its picture..." "Listen, I'm not judging, but you could have been more discreet." "Let me rephrase. You couldn't have been less discreet. This was the PR equivalent of a suicide bombing." She paused. "Was it just a rogue impulse?" "Isn't everything?" She didn't say anything. "You want to know why?" I said. "I don't know why. Jones is a douche." "Don't say that to anyone in the press." "Okay, look. What's done is done. Everyone just wants an update. Some clue about which way you guys are leaning so we can start to spin things."
"You mean are Oliver and I getting back together?"
"Yes."
A guffaw flew from my mouth as though someone had Heimlich'd it out.
"Okay," she said. "Well, one last thing. Gwendolyn is upset enough that the studio is getting even more upset on her behalf."
"Fuck Gwendolyn, seriously.
She's very protective of her creation.
I am not her creation. She's not God."
"No, but her franchise has made you and me and a lot of other people a lot of money. All she wants is to meet. Gavin Dupre personally requested that you meet with her and smooth her feathers."
"I'm busy this week."
"No, you're not."
I hung up on Siobhan. This lacked gravitas on a smartphone, jabbing at a picture of a button. For a while, I lay in bed smoking weed and watching a reality show where facelifts in Hervé Légère, bandage dresses, slop martinis around, and talk shit on each other. Some of these women have had so much work done, their words come out all mushy because they can't move their lips. With their spooky round eyes and stubby little snouts, they look like cats transformed into humans by an incompetent wizard. I wondered if I could spend the rest of my life lying around this house watching TV. I wondered how long it would take for the morning glory to grow over the windows, sealing me in.
I'd been on the verge of being cast in Archangel when Gavin Dupre set down his coffee cup at our breakfast meeting and very quietly and politely asked me to stand up and take off my clothes. I was surprised for half a second and embarrassed about being dumb enough to have been surprised ever after. We were alone in a hotel suite in Beverly Hills, facing each other across a little white-draped table laden with a silver coffee service and a multi-tiered stand of miniature quiches and tarts and croissants that Gavin had kept telling me to eat before he asked me to get naked.
"I promise you will get fat from one little croissant," he'd said. "Look how tiny it is. Just have a taste. A taste won't hurt you."
It wasn't like I hadn't encountered creeps before. They're on every set and in every executive hierarchy like they're mandated by some sort of local